Carpenter brings you Meet the Press, the prize-winning interview program produced by Lawrence E. Spivak. Four of America's top news reporters are ready for this conference, which is spontaneous and unrehearsed. Here is the moderator of Meet the Press, Ned Brooks.
Welcome once again to Meet the Press. Our guest today is Senator George Aiken, Republican of Vermont. He is a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, which has just concluded its inquiry into the spy plane incident and the collapse of the summit conference. Senator Aiken's committee assignments highlight his influence in Republican policymaking for the 1960 campaign on both the foreign and domestic fronts. He is a member of the Republican Policy Committee of the Senate, also the ranking Republican and former chairman of the Senate Agriculture Committee. He serves also on the Joint Atomic Energy Committee. Senator Aiken is often identified with the liberal wing of his party. He is now concluding his 20th year in the Senate. Before coming to Washington, he served two terms as governor of Vermont. And now seated around the press table, ready to interview Senator Aiken, are Richard Wilson of the Coles Publications, Marcus Childs of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, John Steele of Time and Life magazines, and Lawrence E. Spivak, our regular member of the Meet the Press panel. Now, Senator Aiken, if you're ready, we'll start the questions with Mr. Spivak.
Senator Aiken, after the collapse of the summit, your fellow Republican, Governor Rockefeller, said this: the people need to know what went wrong, where we are, and where we're going. Would you say that your investigation found the answer to what went wrong?
I think that our investigation clarified the air considerably, or at least it will after we make our report to the public, as I'm sure that we eventually will. The inquiry revolved around three decisions which had been made by the executive branch of our government. The first decision was to send the U-2 on a mission just shortly prior to the summit meeting. The second decision that we inquired into was the decision to tell the truth after we found that Mr. Khrushchev and company had taken both the plane and the pilot. And the third decision was the one in which our government agreed not to do it again, or at least our president said that we would discontinue such overflights in the future.
Well, do you think it was wise, do you personally think it was wise to send the U-2 over to the Soviet Union just before the summit?
Well, it's difficult to tell whether that was wise or not. Now, we are in agreement, I think, after the hearings on the events leading up to these different decisions which were made, but there will probably always be an argument as to the wisdom of reaching those decisions.
Well, I was asking now, for your judgment on that. Do you think it was wise? Do you personally think it was wise?
Not knowing any more than I do now, we might say, about the exact purpose of that mission, I couldn't say. I don't believe I would have, unless it was something very special, very urgent, have agreed to sending that U-2 over Russia so soon before the summit meeting.
Well, Senator, did that hearing, you spent quite a number of days and took the time of a number of very important officials. Did that hearing reveal anything at all to you, the testimony you took, that is of importance for the American
people? Well, going back to your last question, we were told there was a special purpose in sending you two over at that time, but we were not told what the purpose was. I think that it did more to, it gave us a chronological history of what happened between the 29th of April and the 17th of May, and it also gave us information as to who was involved in the different meetings that were had, which led up to the making of the decisions.
Senator, I'd like to get your impression of the value of this hearing, which took so much time and used the time of so many valuable people. What good do you think this hearing accomplished?
I think
And what harm do you think it accomplished?
I think there would have been a great deal of harm done and a lot of suspicion aroused if we had not had a hearing. Now, as for what actual good will be accomplished, I think that we will take the testimony which was given, pull the strings together, tie a knot in them, and have something of an accurate and authentic history as to what went on preceding the U-2 flight, or at the, from the time of the U-2 flight up until the summit meeting collapsed completely and the president came home.
Do I understand by that that you're going to have a unanimous report? You're going to tie things together and have a unanimous report?
I don't think there'll be a unanimous report. The staff is now drawing up a factual report which will be submitted to each of the 17 members of the committee. And we will meet in probably the last of this week to decide what to do about it. There may be one report, there may be 17 reports, there may be nobody knows how many reports.
Mr. Steele.
Senator, you heard the Director of Central Intelligence, the Defense Secretary, the Secretary of State, and other top government officials in this inquiry. It still isn't clear to me as to whether you believe that the flight just shortly before the summit of the U-2 plane over Russia was a well-conceived idea, or whether you think it's a mistake. Will you clarify?
Mr. Steele, we were told, our committee was told, that there was a special purpose for sending the U-2 over Russia at that time, but we were never told just what that purpose was.
They didn't.
And that's what makes it so difficult to determine whether you or I or anyone else would have arrived at the same decision.
Even behind closed doors, they would not tell you in secrecy
they never
the purpose
told us,
of this flight?
They never told us what the exact purpose of the flight was.
Were the government witnesses asked that question?
Yes.
What was their explanation? Why wouldn't they tell you as United States senators?
They said they would rather not say.
And they weren't pushed on it?
Well, they... I suppose they fell back on a prerogative that they seemed to think was theirs.
Did this go beyond the general explanation of why the flights were necessary, which was by the explanation made by administration leaders that the flights were necessary to study production facilities and missile sites? Did this reason go beyond
that? As I understand it, the importance of this particular flight in the minds of those concerned justified the risk which they must have known they were taking.
Now, what about the second subject, the second decision which you've mentioned, which was the decision after some initial hesitancy to tell the truth about the Powers, Lieutenant Powers' flight? Was this a proper decision or was it a mistake?
Well, we'll have to leave that to history, I think. It was a precedent-making decision. So far as we know, no country in the world had ever told the truth about espionage work before. And when the president virtually took it upon himself, the Secretary of State took it upon himself to tell the truth in the matter, it really established a precedent. It was rather astonishing, I think, to some of the countries with which we are allied, and as to whether it will redound to our credit or to our loss, it's very difficult to tell at this time.
Well, you've heard all the testimony. What's your judgment, Senator?
I think I've had a temporary setback. I think we might go back 200 years to the time that little George Washington cut down his parents' cherry tree, and he admitted that he did it. Now, the Washington family undoubtedly sustained a loss in the we're chopping down of the cherry tree, but the moral that was established has stood us in good stead now for 200 years.
Well, then are you saying this decision was proper?
And I think there's a temporary setback due to the fact that our government came clean.
You mean in our relations with our allies?
Yes, although paradoxically, we seem to be closer to our allies now than we were before the incident.
Mr.
We seem to be closer together.
Mr. Child.
Senator Aiken, how would you appraise the effect of the whole U-2 business and its aftermath on Vice President Nixon's candidacy for the presidency?
That will depend, Mr. Childs, on how much Mr. Khrushchev keeps talking and who the Democratic nominee for president may be.
Well, you mean you think all these inflammatory statements that Mr. Khrushchev is making is helping Mr. Nixon and the Republicans?
They're helping Mr. Nixon and the Republicans at the present time, and at least one Democratic candidate or near candidate recognizes the situation for what it is.
You think, in other words, that Mr. Khrushchev is trying to elect a Republican? Do you think this is deliberate, Senator Aiken?
No, I think Mr. Khrushchev is very much in earnest in not wanting Mr. Nixon to be president.
And this is a big assist to Mr. Nixon.
Well, for the time being.
I would like to ask you a related question. Governor Rockefeller has had no connection with these events whatsoever. He's maintained his own independent position. He says that he is ready or willing to accept a draft. Do you think there is any chance your party will draft Governor Rockefeller?
No, no.
You
I
rule
don't
that
think
out,
sir? I don't think that there's one chance in a thousand that Nelson Rockefeller will be drafted.
Why is that?
Because I think that the delegates, majority of them, are pretty well committed to Mr. Nixon at the present time. I'm glad that Mr. Rockefeller has seen fit to enter into the campaign because he has put a little life into it, and there was no life into it in it up until the time he went out to North Dakota.
Mr. Wilson.
Senator Aiken, you referred to the fact that the various witnesses before your committee did not advise you of the exact mission of the U-2 flight on May 1st. Since the termination of the hearings, has any request been made of the President or the Director of Central Intelligence or any other responsible official for this exact information on what the flight was for?
Not that I know of, Mr. Wilson. We concluded the hearings with Secretary Gates on Thursday. And so far as I know, there's been no more specific request made of the executive branch since that time.
How can the committee reach a judgment as to the wisdom of the flight on that day if it does not know the purpose?
Well, as one member of the committee, I find it very difficult to arrive at a decision. If it was a routine flight, it would seem that it had better been postponed. If there were some very urgent reason, as we have been led to believe, then I think perhaps we ought to know the reason. But we haven't had it given to us yet.
Well, this point of view that you express has no influence with Mr. Dulles or others who had responsibility in connection with the flight?
We have not seen Mr. Dulles since this testimony was given.
Do you think it would be wise for the committee to ask the President what the purpose of the flight was?
Yes, I'd like to know.
Now, in general, was the committee more satisfied with administration policy or less satisfied as a result of the hearings? Your judgment of what the committee's reaction is.
I don't know how to answer that, Mr. Wilson. There are 17 members of the committee, and about three-quarters of them were in attendance most of the time during the hearings. I am happier that these heads of departments that were concerned with the events between May 1st and May 17th did come before the committee and tell us as much as they did. They told us some things we didn't know before. So I think the hearings were a good thing, and I think they were helpful to the committee. They weren't completely satisfactory, however, and there are some details which perhaps we never will get.
Were you impressed by the success of the U-2 flights in general or not?
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. They showed us beautiful pictures, photographs of Russian bases,
missile bases,
Navy yards.
Could you see the missiles in place?
Well, I'm not an expert, and I probably wouldn't recognize a missile from 10 miles up in the air. Anyway, but I would say that the pictures of the Russian bases were about as clear as the picture of the San Diego base which the president showed the American people the other night.
Just one final question on this point. Was it concluded by you or the committee or by anyone else that the Russians were weaker than they had permitted the world to believe? These photographs revealed that weakness.
I have felt that all the time, and the photographs showed the progress of the work they had been making from year to year. We certainly know a great deal about the Russian bases, but the revelation of the flight of the U-2 must have convinced the Russian people, or those who were permitted to know, that Russia was much weaker than she had boasted of being.
Mr. Spivak.
Senator Aiken, did I understand you to say a minute ago that you thought Mr. Khrushchev's statements, his wild statements, were helping at least one Democratic candidate?
Well, I think that Lyndon Johnson recognizes the dangers inherent, the political dangers inherent in Mr. Khrushchev's action, and is forestalling any disastrous results to the Democratic Party as much as he can. On the other hand, though, I want to say that I think Lyndon Johnson firmly believes in standing up for the President of the United States.
Your feeling, then, is that this whole affair might help the Republicans and hurt the Democrats in this coming election?
Well, if Mr. Stevenson should be the Democratic candidate and Mr. Khrushchev keeps on with his threats and his denouncement of Richard Nixon, I would expect it would help the Republicans.
Senator, judging by the press of the world, the feeling is strong everywhere that Mr. Khrushchev has conducted himself in foreign affairs as a cheap, tough gangster. Do you think under those circumstances that any president of the United States ought to go to a summit meeting with him? Until the Russian people have gotten rid of that kind of leadership?
I don't think anything would be accomplished by another summit meeting with Mr. Khrushchev. Mr. Khrushchev acts scared. He acts panicky. Just what he's scared of, I don't know. But his violent tirades would indicate that something is creeping up pretty close behind him.
Mr. Khrushchev has said that the Russian people, the Soviet Union, should not go to another summit meeting with President Eisenhower. You then think that the Russian people ought to be told that we won't go to another summit meeting as long as Mr. Khrushchev is their leader?
I think we ought to tell the Russian people the facts as much as we can, and one of those facts is that probably nothing could be accomplished at a summit meeting or any other meeting with Mr. Khrushchev being present as the Soviet delegate or representative.
Mr. Steele.
Governor, I beg your pardon, Senator, what do you see as the reasons behind the repeated Khrushchev blasts? You have gotten some pretty good testimony from high-level witnesses in the committee. How do you explain them? What do you think the trouble is?
Mr. Khrushchev didn't get the acclaim from the world that he thought he was going to get. He didn't get the favorable response that he thought he was going to get. He acts now like a man who had committed some outrageous crime and felt that he might be caught up with. And I think that the results from a summit meeting, the reaction around the world was a great disappointment to him. Further than that, I expect he's in for a great deal of criticism and justifiable criticism at home.
Well, now, his conduct has been compared by some to that of Adolf Hitler's before World War II. Does this pose the possibility of an actual explosion through one man's action, perhaps?
Well, as a man gets desperate, he becomes more dangerous, particularly if he has the power in his hands that Mr. Khrushchev has. If he becomes a madman like Adolf Hitler, we've got to watch him.
What do our people think? Do they think that this is simply a madness setting in on his part, or is it pressure from his army or Stalinist elements? What kind of information do you get?
I think it's a little of everything. I think he was under pressure from his own military people at home. I think he was under pressure from China, very severe pressure from China. Now I think he's under criticism from most of the neutral world. And when a man is fighting for his life, either his political life or for his life literally, he's likely to be dangerous. So I wouldn't underestimate any of Mr. Khrushchev's threats or statements.
Mr. Childs.
Senator, some critics have said that the President Eisenhower's big mistake was to invite Khrushchev to America last year, that this was a form of appeasement, and that it has encouraged Castro of Cuba and others to issue similar invitations now. Do you think that was a mistake that
No.
last year? You do not?
No.
How do you justify it, Senator?
I think that there was a great deal of progress made towards a better understanding between the different countries of the world as a result of Mr. Khrushchev's reasonably good reception over here. And there was a let-up in the Cold War. And if things could have gone on, if Mr. Khrushchev hadn't got himself on a spot before the summit meeting, we might have had some real progress towards peace. Not a great deal, but just a little step.
Well, do you subscribe to the belief that he was on the spot, as you put it, before the U-2 incident?
Oh, yes, I think he was. I think he had to scuttle the summit conference anyway. He was on the spot as far as Berlin was concerned. He had virtually promised that he was going to straighten out the Berlin situation. And as the summit conference drew nearer, it began to appear that he couldn't do what he had promised to do without jeopardizing the peace of Europe or of the world. And he just couldn't win.
But you will recall that Secretary Herter made a pretty categorical answer when he was asked whether the U-2 incident had contributed to the collapse of the summit. And he said he believed it had. Although there were indications, he also said that Mr. Khrushchev was uneasy about it before.
I think the U-2 incident was manna from heaven for Mr. Khrushchev. It gave him the excuse that he had been looking for. He would have had to have found some other excuse had it not been for the U-2.
But what, Senator, if we had not given him the excuse?
Well, they might have had the summer conference. It might have dragged on and nothing accomplished. He couldn't have accomplished anything. Nobody could have. Probably the greatest accomplishment had the summit meeting gone off as planned would have been an agreement to have another meeting.
Mr. Wilson.
Senator, you have expressed doubt about the wisdom of this particular flight on May 1st. Who was at fault? Was President Eisenhower at fault on that particular day and that particular flight?
I think President Eisenhower had given general approval for these flights. I don't think that he knew what particular day or hour that this flight would take place. We were told that it was made on the 1st of May because on that day the weather was clear and conditions were good all across the area where the U-2 was to fly.
Well, Senator, you've gotten at the very point that so many critics make with respect to the president's relationship to these flights, that he did authorize them in general, but that he did not carefully follow them so that these events would not interfere with the summit conference.
I don't think the president should follow those programs in detail. He had given general approval to the overflights of the U-2 over Russian territory. But I don't think that he should have attempted to follow them in detail.
Yet in his
speech. I don't think that President Eisenhower should have assumed full responsibility for what happened
in
the case of the U-2.
Yet in his speech about a week ago, he said that he authorized this flight. He said that it was necessary to undertake it because conditions might change and they may not be able to get the same information. That was a general subject of his.
Well, if the flight were to be made, that was probably the day it had to be made.
Let me ask you one final question on politics to clear up something Mr. Childs asked you. You said that you did not think Governor Rockefeller could be drafted for president. Do you think he's the most likely nominee for vice president?
No.
Who is?
Oh, there are many likable and willing
Senator Mr.
persons
Steele.
Who would take that position.
Mr. Steele.
Senator, who's your favorite candidate for the Republican vice presidential nomination?
I have no choice. There's several of them. New York State alone has three. They have the Attorney General, Bill Rogers. They have Senators Keating, Senator Javits, and we have Senator Scott. I think that the...
Who would be the most attractive, sir?
Well, I think that the vice presidential candidate should be politically to the left of Mr. Nixon and preferably from somewhere near the East Coast.
Who's that?
Are you for Mr. Nixon?
I've named five or six.
Senator, are you personally for Mr. Nixon for president?
I expect to support Mr. Nixon.
Gentlemen, I think on that note we'll have to bring the proceedings to a close. I'm very sorry to interrupt, but I see that our time is up.
And Monitor's thanks to Senator George D. Aiken and the members of the Meet the Press panel for a stimulating and enlightening half hour. Those panelists were John Steele of Time Life Incorporated, Marquis Childs of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Richard Bilson of Coles Publications, and Lawrence Spivak, the producer of Meet the Press. Well, as usual here, a personal word, if I may. Where traffic laws are rigidly enforced and obeyed, traffic deaths have gone down. Do you really conscientiously obey traffic laws, or do you sneak through those familiar stop signs? Do you add 5 or 10 miles an hour to the posted speed limit? Or do you fail to signal turns? Who are you kidding? Too many drivers don't seem to believe that those traffic fatality figures could include them. When more than 100 drivers were killed on an average day last year, they too didn't believe it could happen to them. Yet most of those drivers were violating the law at the time of the accident. On an annual basis, about 1/5 of all fatal traffic accidents involve a driver or a pedestrian who's been drinking, and it's against the law to drink and drive. About 3 out of 10 were violating a speed law. These National Safety Council figures plainly show that you have a much better chance of staying alive and enjoying that drive if you stay within the law and without traffic trouble. And so saying, I find the time for me for this Monitor Week has run out. Parts of the preceding half hour were pre-recorded. Will we see you again next week? Fine. Till then, this is Ben Grauer saying, may the days between be pleasant ones at your house and at mine. And now, good night.